Welcome back to the Education Matters podcast. We got on TV episodes when they say they have a very special episode. We have a very special episode of the Education Matters podcast today. A conversation with Capella University's president, Scott Kinney. I was holding off on talking to Scott and other Capella leaders or executives because I wanted to kind of get this podcast thing down first, and I wanted it to be about learners and faculty primarily. But we're far enough along now that I felt like it was a really good opportunity to get Scott in here. And it's a really great conversation. We talk for about 40 minutes and we cover a range of topics from Scott's story to his perspectives coming into Capella, his views of the faculty and learners and kind of where we're headed, and then some personal stuff. It's a different kind of conversation than what I've had on other podcasts, and I really enjoyed it. Scott's not just a colleague, he's a friend, and it was a really good conversation. And I think for those listening to it, either Capella faculty and employees or learners, it'll give you a little bit different picture of Capella's president. So here's the conversation with me and Scott. Scott, thanks for making time to do this.
Thanks, Mike. Happy to be here.
We've got a little bit of time, but if we don't cover everything, we'll come back for round two.
Okay.
But let's start. These are just I think it would be interesting for our learners and for people who work at Capella, our faculty, to know a little bit about you and your story and your own educational journey, because you've been an adult learner. But let's start at the beginning. Where are you from?
Sure. I grew up in Prior Lake, Minnesota. So both my parents were Minnesotans. My dad grew up out on the South Dakota border. My mom up outside of Duluth. And both of them were the only kids in their families going back however many generations and including all siblings and to ever go to college. My dad on the GI Bill and my mom because she had a full ride scholarship.
Yeah. What did
So education was really important in my house growing up. So I grew up as a Minnesotan. We moved to Prior Lake when I was four. Prior Lake, which now is a big suburb, at a population of 800 people. So it was very much a little rural farming community back then.
What did your folks do?
So my dad, who passed away a number of years ago, actually just had the anniversary of his passing 3 days ago. So
really?
I've been thinking about my dad a lot lately. But he worked at Control Data. He was one of Control Data's earlier employees and stayed there for 25 years. And not a tech guy, though, more of a general business guy. And one of his jobs was running a little thing they started up called Control Data Institute, which was a training institution to create people who knew how to run computers.
Yeah.
It was the dawn of the mainframe computer age.
Okay.
And there weren't trained – it was a skills gap problem. And so they started Control Data Institute to train these people mostly so they had access to learners.
Not that different from – I mean, one of the things – I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, but one of the things we're looking at is enterprise software analytics.
Right.
And the challenge that enterprise software analytics companies have of training up their customers to be able to use their products and extract maximum value. It sounds like
right. –
Same exact issue.
Skills gap problem's been around for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what my my dad did. And then my mom was a school teacher. So she was in education as well. And she did that all the way through after my younger brother was born. And then she retired from that.
Yep. What was a Prior Lake childhood like?
So in hindsight, kind of idyllic. But We lived right on the lake, which was not unusual back then. Still a lot of cabins on the lake back then. We had one of a relatively smaller number of year-round homes. But, you know, I went to the same school from kindergarten to 12th grade and knew all the same kids the whole way through and spent a lot of time outdoors.
Yep.
I was big into anything outdoors, fishing and swimming and water skiing on the lake. In the winter, cross-country skiing out the back. And it was kind of a Minnesota rural sort of upbringing.
Yep. So this is a question that I was probably the most excited to ask you about when I was getting ready for the podcast. We met probably, 3.5 years ago when you started?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this one of the first things we talked about, but I don't remember getting a great answer. You went to Dartmouth, and you majored in
geology.
Geology.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you major in geology?
Well, it was not too hard of a choice. I didn't have I've never been one of these people who knew exactly what they wanted to do with their whole lives.
Yep.
I've never quite understood people at the age of eight. They decide they want to be a doctor, and then they
that
just
was it. That was,
maybe I'm a little bit envious of them, but I'm not that kind of person. So I went to college. Finding myself at Dartmouth was intimidating and weird to begin with.
How did you find yourself at Dartmouth?
Well, it's only 20% of my high school graduating class went to college at all. Most of them went into
really?
The service or went to work.
Okay.
And it was just, you know, rural America.
Sure.
And I was a good student, and my parents wanted me to go to college. Neither one of them had ever heard of Dartmouth, though, either. And we had taken a family camping trip. We did this every summer, and we were out in kind of the maritime provinces of Canada.
Uh-huh.
And we came back through the U.S. through New England and stopped in Hanover, and I saw Dartmouth. I thought, wow, this place is fantastic. And then I went to the library, and I looked it up in the 10-year-old Barron's Guide to American Colleges, and it said 4,000 men, 0 women. And I thought, well, I'm not sure I want to do that.
Not a great ratio.
That was true 10 years before, but they had started admitting women only a few years before, and not that many. But for whatever reason, because it's very outdoors oriented, it was probably my biggest. And I knew it was a good school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied there and one school in Minnesota. That's it. And I got into Dartmouth. Actually, quick, if you don't mind, quick story. So the reason I ended up there, I also applied to Gustavus. My mom went to Gustavus. Gustavus is a really good school.
Yeah.
And my mom had been grooming me to go to Gustavus since pre-infancy. And so I applied there. And I applied to Dartmouth. I got into both. And I was on the phone with one of her best friends from college who was the admissions director at Gustavus.
Okay.
And they were recruiting me to play soccer, too. I was a soccer player in high school and had some minor level of interest in playing in college.
Yep.
And so I'm on the phone with the admissions director. And he said, well, we'd love to have you come to Gustavus. Where else did you apply? I said, well, just one other place at Dartmouth. And he said, well, did you get in? I said, yes. He said, oh, you should go there.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, well, if the admissions director of Gustavus is telling me I should go to the other place, maybe I should pay attention to that.
Something to take seriously.
So anyway, you asked about geology. So that's how I ended up at Dartmouth. And I like the sciences a lot. I like the combination of analytical work and creative work. And geology is not quite as hard a science as physics or chemistry. It's more of an applied science because you got to figure out, you know, why does this landform look the way it does? And I knew I'd get to spend a lot of time outside. turns out you spend a lot of time in the lab, too. I didn't realize I was signing up for that. But that was the main reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you get out of Dartmouth. You've got your geology degree. What next?
So there are no jobs in geology.
Yeah.
Between 1979 and 1983, which is when I was in college, geology went from boom to bust, and it stayed bust for about 25 years. And it's boomed the last 5 years.
It was booming about oil and natural resources and
mining, oil, USGS. Everybody was getting lots of interesting job offers. And I thought that's what I was going to do. And I was ready to go to work. I didn't necessarily want to just go on and get a graduate degree right away. So but that dried up very quickly around 1981, 1982. So I had to do something else. Now, I knew how to program computers. I taught myself that when I was about 10 years old.
Okay.
My dad, being a control data, had access to great big terminals that you plug your phone into. And so I learned how to program computers. And I'd taken a couple of courses at Dartmouth. The president there at the time is a guy named John Kemeny, who invented the basic computer language.
Interesting.
And so it was an early pioneer in computer science. And so I got a job down south of Boston writing code in COBOL and Fortran and Pascal and assembly language. And it was a great job, one of my favorite jobs I ever had. But, you know, I had to do something, and I wanted to go to work. I knew a guy who was at this little company, and I ended up getting a job there.
Cool. At what point, you got an MBA.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did it make sense to you that business was a path that you wanted to take?
Yeah. So I was on a technology path. I spent 2 years at this whole startup in Boston hammering out code. And then I moved to Minneapolis.
Yep.
I came back for some family reasons and Lived in Minneapolis and worked for a little spinoff of Control Data. I mean, my dad had nothing to do with it, but called Citrol, that was and I was a software developer there as well. But then they started up a marketing department for the first time in their relatively short history, and they recruited me into the marketing department. They thought I was one of the few coders who could actually talk to clients. And I really liked it. You know, I missed having my hands on the keys and writing code, because that can be a very satisfying job. But I really was interested in what the client's problems were and how to solve those problems and how to communicate with them about that and how to negotiate. I really found it pretty intriguing. And that's what inspired me. I'd never been thinking about going back to business school. That's what inspired me to do that. I ended up going to Stanford, which was a wonderful experience. And then after that, thought about going back to technology. But that was a point at which I at this point, I'd really caught the bug of creating business value and solving problems through business. And I mean, it sounds kind of wonky, but I really enjoy it. And so I went into management consulting instead. And that's when I joined the Boston Consulting Group, and I spent about 8 years there.
Take us through well, here, one other thing I wanted to get to. You're at BCG, and I think it was at BCG. Is that when you went to Australia?
Yes.
You've talked a lot about that. Talk, explain a little bit about how you ended up in Australia and what that experience was like.
Yeah. It was a transformative experience in a number of ways. And I, you know, whether you're a Capella employee or a Capella learner, if you have the opportunity to work and live overseas, I strongly encourage you to try to make it happen. It's hard to make happen, right? Yeah. So a lot of people think, oh, it's just going to be too hard, kids, schools, whatever. But my wife, Barbara, had just completed her PhD in molecular biology. She was looking to do something different. Australia is actually a big leader in biotech in certain ways. It's one of the pioneers of IVF, in vitro fertilization, for just for example. But we went down to Australia. Professionally and personally, it was two of the most enriching years of my life and my career. So on the personal front, we made some great lifelong friends, really immersed ourselves in another culture. And even though they speak English, it is another culture. And so you do go through that a bit of culture shock and adjustment, but you can talk to people. So actually not at first. You can talk to them. They understand you. You just don't understand what they're saying. But we figured it out soon enough. And we had our first daughter down there, and we really loved the experience. And professionally, it was fantastic because you're exposed to business situations and as a management consultant, challenges that you're not very familiar with. They have different laws that are governing all sorts of things, and you got to figure all that out, and you got to be able to add value. So it stretched me professionally, and really it was the genesis for my ending up at Capella. And,
Take me through that. So before we – let's park that for a second, because I think there's something you talked about, like going into a strange environment where the rules of the road aren't exactly clear. And you're in a position where you have to be able to figure out the dynamics of a client's problems and give them a pathway to solution, and it's a totally different environment for you. What are the tools that you rely on? And I think this would be interesting and useful for listeners, whether they're Capella employees or faculty or learners. What are the tools that you rely on in that kind of an environment? Because I've watched you work here. And maneuvering around situations where we don't know exactly how things are going to play out. We don't know what the regulatory environment for FlexPath is going to be. And so how do you create the FlexPath program before it's totally clear what the regulatory environment will support? Other you know, how do you innovate in that kind of environment? And I've seen you work through that. What are the tools that you use to do that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, Mike. I'd say one is an attuned and focused sense of observation and empathy. Empathy not just for people and their perspectives, but also for issues and trying to really figure out what's going on. So if it's in the regulatory environment, who are the players? What are their goals? Right? Trying to understand what different stakeholders are trying to accomplish, whether it's Capella's employees, our learners. I think you can't prioritize or drive the right kinds of innovations if you don't really know what is going to make people satisfied and happy at the end of the day and help them accomplish their goals. So I think the ability to observe and then be able to take a lot of disparate information, some of it's quantitative, some of it's qualitative, some of it directly conflicts with each other, and draw some conclusions and observations from that. Yep. And that intellectually I probably find the most stimulating part of the process because I'm interested in what's going on in the world. I want to capture a lot of information. But then you got to force yourself maybe quicker than you're comfortable. And consulting helped with this because we're on tight time frames.
Uh-huh.
And you could wallow around in data forever and have a grand old time. But the client is paying a lot for you to get to the nub of it, right?
Yep.
So then taking all that, drawing some hypotheses, some conclusions, testing those, being really critical and analytically critical. And then I think the third piece is translating that into action. You got to have a vision that people can buy into, that can make sense to them, and motivating a group of leaders to get some things done and towards common goals. So all of those, I think I'm still developing those skills. I'm sure I'll be better at all of them 10 years from now than I am today. I sure hope I am. but the work that I've done in the past has been really helpful.
Back to the kind of your circuitous route to Capella. You're in Australia. How did that start your journey there?
I remember the times, the episodes when it really inspired an interest in workforce development, mid-career professionals who need to take it to the next level. And here's just an example of that. So I did a lot of work in Southeast Asia. Australia was still a small country. At the time, it had 16 million people. That's smaller than several U.S. states, I think. And so if you're the leading manufacturer of almost any product in Australia, you run out of market pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And so it limits your growth, and you either have to get into a lot of other kinds of product areas or take your business overseas. And that's what a lot of leading Australian companies like to do. And Asia is actually a closer and a more accessible market than North America or Europe. And so I did a lot of work with Australian companies about Southeast Asia, either as a place to do manufacturing or as a market, whether it's China or Thailand or Vietnam. And really interesting work, a lot of fun. And especially this is back in the early 90s, these economies were just starting to boom. You might remember the tiger economies of Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of people entering the middle class, a lot of improvement in standards of living, education, technology, communication, all these things were happening at the same time. And really great thing for these countries and for society as a whole. But you didn't have to think too hard, especially once you move from Thailand to, say, India or to China that have a billion plus people.
Yep.
And figure, okay, it's not just manufacturing jobs that are going to, you know, move out of the U.S. and into other places. It's going to be leadership of knowledge-based economies, which is where the U.S.'s main engine for economic growth was coming from.
Yep.
And so I remember thinking, okay, that's going to be a big challenge for the U.S. And how are they going to overcome that? Because you need lifelong learning. You need people. We still, even though back then we led the world in the percentage of adults who had a post-secondary degree at about 32%, here it is 22 years later. We're at about the same percentage, and the rest of the world has passed us, or 12 countries have. So we've gone from first to 13th.
Yep.
And as you know well, President Obama, the Lumina Foundation have set some audacious goals for reversing that trend. And even though progress has gotten in the positive direction, it's not nearly rapid enough.
Yep.
And so one of the big appeals about Capella when I joined here 4 years ago, this is probably true for you as well, is we can do something to change that. We're focused on the right people, and we've got the right innovative vision.
Yep. Let's jump to that. So it's been about 4 years, a little less. What have you learned as president of Capella?
So one thing that I've learned that came as a bit of a surprise to me is that even though I primarily came here to solve some big thorny challenges facing the United States in terms of completion rates of mid-career professionals, of graduate degree programs, affordability of those programs, these are big, thorny, important challenges. I am absolutely energized by the individual transformation that our learners can go through and how that unlocks power and opportunity for them. And before I came to Capella, it's not like that was a foreign concept. But and I think it's what draws a lot of employees here.
Yeah.
Because they find tremendous reward and satisfaction in being a part of that. And I wasn't opposed to it. I actually was quite interested in it. But what I found is that it resonates with me emotionally pretty deeply.
Yep.
And so that's something that I've learned. And I think that is powerful. You don't want to get overwhelmed by that and overly distracted and focus exclusively on that. But that's how it's learner by learner by learner is how we're going to solve these big problems. So that's one thing I've learned. One other is that this is one of the most complex and dynamic environments in which to do business that I've ever encountered.
Yeah.
Every possible box that I can think of about complexity. How many competitors do we have? What's the local, state, and federal regulatory environment like? Yeah. What is the technology environment? Is it changing rapidly or slowly? They're all at the high end of the extreme in every case.
Yep.
Now, I find that much more motivating than demotivating because, to me, if you're in that kind of environment, there will be people who navigate it successfully and those who don't. The better you've got a sense of where you're going, and even though things are going to change, you know, every week, you know this better than anybody. Every week, something happens that we weren't quite expecting, or it happens in a different way, or a new issue pops its head up, and so we've got to stay nimble. We've got to be on top of that.
I love that part of the job, right? I feel like the idea of staying nimble or acting quickly or acting within a sense of urgency, those words have been overused to the point of taking away their meaning to a degree. But you can't not be those things and succeed when the landscape changes every single week, right? Every single week. We don't know what set of challenges we're going to face in order to be able to innovate, in order to be able to best serve our learners, in order to best be able to support our faculty. It changes regulatorily, programmatically. The best laid plans don't ever quite go in a straight line. Mm-hmm. And that's the best part to me, not knowing.
Right.
That's what makes it fun.
It does. It makes it exciting. If you don't like those things, this would not be the right industry to be in.
It's a tough environment. And we've had some people come through who don't like those things, and it really doesn't work out.
Right.
What's a good day for you? When you go home, driving back to Eagan, and you're like, that was a good one. Why was it a good one?
So the best days for me involve our learners or our faculty or our staff here in Minneapolis in one way or another. So the days that even if it might be long and they've been grueling in the sense of lots of interaction, even if it's difficult because we're working through some challenging issues, if I'm having interactions with learners, faculty in particular, because those are the front lines for us, right? Then I feel like I've been doing my job and that I've been helping to move us forward, even though it doesn't always – sometimes you have to look back a few months or even longer. The opposite of that, if I rarely have days like this, but if I'm sitting down doing email or – that's important too. But it doesn't feel to me as impactful.
Yep. Totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
What makes a great Capella faculty member?
So I think I am getting better at having a clearer understanding of that. One quick story, and I'm embarrassed, actually kind of, ashamed of myself in retrospect. When I came to Capella, for no particular reason, probably based on the same external factors where you've got people who are biased against online education mm-hmm. or for-profit education, I assumed our faculty would be middle tier at best, mm-hmm. And maybe bottom third. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, but that's probably – and so I was here for a few weeks, and I went to one of our PhD colloquia. It was down in Scottsdale, Arizona. Uh-huh. And I get there. It's already up and running. I go to a session. And I Martha Hollis, if you're a Capella faculty member listening, you might know Martha, was presenting at the front of the room. There were a couple other Capella faculty members with her, about 50 or 60 learners. Within 10 minutes, I thought, holy cow. Mm-hmm. I lucked out. I got in the room that has the really great faculty members. And then over the next few hours, I bounced around to 10 or 12 other rooms.
Yep.
And saw Capella's faculty in action, and I thought, what a schmuck I am for making that kind of assumption that is, A, wildly inaccurate, and B, kind of, pessimistic. So our faculty, what makes them a great faculty member is, it's simple to me. They are passionate about their learners' success. And we have a lot of faculty members who wouldn't necessarily want to be the sage on the stage, the person in front of a economics 101 classroom at the University of Minnesota with 300 or 400 or 800 students in a room. There are some faculty members that's exactly what they want to do.
Yeah.
Most of our faculty members either are disinterested. They might be – some of them are probably great at that. But they're passionate about each learner – cracking the code, making these breakthroughs where they figure out how to master a competency, how to perform better in the workplace, how to be a better scholar, a better practitioner. And that's what makes a good faculty member.
These podcasts have been a really good tool for me to get to know our faculty in a little bit deeper way than what I had before, right? More than what you do in meetings or hallway conversations or you meet them at commencement, but to really get into it. And a common theme about almost all of these conversations is these are people with extremely diverse backgrounds who've practiced in the field in which they're teaching. And I think about how far away that is, and not that my experience is typical. In fact, statistics would tell you it's not typical. But I was a 18 to 22-year-old, first-time, full-time college student at Creighton University. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm learning political science from somebody who knows political science from having written a book about it and researched it, but it's never gone. And there were specific examples of that, and that doesn't describe our faculty.
No, and they are much more entrepreneurial mm-hmm. than a traditional faculty member. A traditional faculty member is actually quite risk averse. They're in an industry that is 1,000 years old and has resisted change for all 10 of those centuries. And they personally are, many of them are interested in a tenured position where they can kind of focus on the things that they want to focus on, but they don't have to perform in the same kind of way. Our faculty they have done all sorts of different kinds of things, especially our part-time and adjunct faculty. Yeah. They're doing a lot of different things right now.
Yep.
But our core faculty, also very entrepreneurial, and I think that's what makes them great faculty members for our learners because they can draw from a breadth of real-world, real-life situations, not just the research that they've done to publish.
Yep, yep. And that's not to discount all the great professors at Creighton University. But I mean, it is. When I walked away, that was the kind of lasting picture I had in my head. Idea of the sage on the stage.
Well, and not only that, they are mostly, and maybe this has changed a bit, but they were there to create scholars. They weren't there to create a more engaged, energized, capable workforce. They were there to create scholars.
Yep.
Only 10% of Americans had college degrees as recently as 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so that model of creating scholars, you could argue that's not a bad way to do it.
Yeah.
But that's not what people are going back to school for today.
Exactly. I was at a conversation, at a dinner conversation, and there was someone at the table who runs a foundation in Washington, D.C., and we were talking about competency-based education. And he said, competency-based education can't tell you what makes it can't tell you what makes a poem great and experience a great poem. And I told him, first of all, I don't agree with that. I just don't agree. That's not true. But second, an 18 to 22-year-old who maybe hasn't experienced deeply the opportunity to engage with poetry should have that opportunity because maybe they love it and maybe they have a facility for it that they need to be exposed to and have developed. A 35-year-old working mother in a career, looking to advance her career, shouldn't have to waste time on poetry if she doesn't want to spend time on poetry.
Right.
And it's a fundamentally different kind of learner. And, right. and you know, I think that's one of the big opportunities that we have and challenges is to reorient public conversation around the kind of learners that we serve versus the kind of learner that exists in, I think, the public's mind and the policymaker's mind.
Yeah. Painting it as either or is unhelpful and kind of destructive in the conclusions that you might come to. I think the 18 to 22-year-old on campus coming-of-age experience which is bundled together unnecessarily but conveniently with getting an education, getting a basic, you know, exposed to a lot of different fields and learning how to think critically. That's going to be around for a long, long time. That is a healthy industry, and they can charge a lot of money for it. It's not going away. We're not trying to disrupt that.
Yeah.
What is it down to? Under 20% of the market.
15%,
I think, yeah.
Yeah. Shifting gears, for any learners out there listening to this, you've had almost 4 years worth of exposure to learners who have succeeded at Capella and those who've had challenges at Capella. What advice do you have for learners about how to approach their degree, how to think about what they're going to do with their degree and their careers, and how to be successful both at Capella and then after Capella?
Yeah, well, there's a lot in there, right?
And I need that in 2 minutes.
Yeah. Let me just pick on a couple of things from that. We've done a lot of work analyzing terabytes of data about who's succeeding in their programs and why, who's struggling and why, which interventions work, which ones don't work as well. And at the end of the day, the biggest success factor, I think by far, is the personal ownership and perseverance of the learner. Now, we want to make it as, we use the term most direct path, we want to make that as easy as possible.
Yep.
But unlike, say, probably the most extreme example would be a boarding school for high school students or something where they are going to drag you across the finish line no matter what and work. You still have to do a lot of work probably. But our learners are self-motivated. That's why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
But keeping your goal in sight, reminding yourself why you're doing this, as long as you still have – in your head, a good reason why you're doing this, and pushing yourself to meet deadlines and to do your best work, having something that motivates you, whether it's thinking about a promise that you made to a family member or your own satisfaction you're going to feel when you complete something that's so demanding, that's the biggest success factor. Uh-huh. And so finding that source of motivation, that would be my advice, is have something that motivates you. And it's different for different people.
Yep.
For some, it is external. For some, it's more intrinsic. That would be probably the biggest advice that I have. And then I'd also say, at the end, it is worth it. You can find examples. You find plenty of examples of people who never got an advanced education who were very successful in their lives, and the opposite. But those are they stand out because they are the exceptions.
Yep.
It's still true today, even in an overly expensive higher education system, that the returns are there.
Yep.
And so reminding themselves of that, and also especially we're a doctoral institution by heritage. We started there. You will be Dr. Buttrey the rest of your life. Nobody can take that away from you.
Yep. When we were at commencement in March and we got to listen to Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth, who received her PhD at that commencement, talk about her journey and how hard it was, but how fulfilling and valuable it was to cross the finish line.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that sticks with you. And I think it stuck with everybody who was in the audience to hear it that day. So we could talk forever. I've got like a million more questions, so we're going to have to come back.
We'll have a round two.
So, yeah. But I'm going to take a personal privilege. We've got about 3 minutes left. I want to take a personal privilege on the last question. So you and I have something in common that we both had have two daughters, and they're the same kind of space and age, about a couple years apart. And we both had them at roughly the same ages. Now, there's a little difference between your age and my age, but not that much. But yours are empty nesters. You're an empty nester. They're off
they're
at college,
both in college
now.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for a father of two daughters?
For you, yeah. hang in there would be the first one. Being a father of daughters is a wonderful privilege.
The best.
You're fortunate with that. Your kids are, I would say raising teenage daughters is challenging. You mentioned you've had some sleepless nights lately, more back related, but you'll have more sleepless nights. And
I feel especially unprepared for teenage daughters.
There's no great preparation that I'm aware of. But here's what I would say, sort of similar to the advice to learners, I remember it was tough being a 13, 14, 15-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. It's really tough being a 13, 14, 15-year-old girl, I think. And I think it's harder, frankly. And you will be part of that. When they come out the other side, knowing that all the work you put into teach them what is important to you and to your wife now, you'll see that come out in the young adults that they are when they're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old.
Yep.
And they're still not done, by the way. But but that's really gratifying. And enjoy it. And it's over so quick. I saw a movie last night with my 19-year-old daughter who's home for the summer. And my wife.
It's nice that she goes to movies with you.
It is.
So something must be working.
Something must be working. And it's called Inside Out. I don't know if you've heard of it. I highly recommend it to everybody.
Okay.
And if you're a parent of daughters, if you don't care that your kid might see you sobbing, or you think that might be an okay thing for your child to see you sobbing, go to that movie.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. 4 stars.
Filed away. All right. There's something to do this weekend. Well, thank you for doing this. We'll come back around
round
two in a couple months.
Would love to.
Really appreciated this. This is fun.
Thanks, Mike.
Cool.